Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. This is the second part of our look at Alan Klein. And in our first part, we managed to get all the way from his origins as a talented accountant, he said euphemistically, through to getting an in with the Beatles in January 1969 after John Lennon had given an interview where he perhaps over-egged the pudding on how bad the finances were, but certainly offered a gap in the Beatles' armour for Alan Klein to strike. And the deal that's eventually set up is that they will meet Alan Klein and John Lennon and Yoko Ono on the 27th of January at the Dorchester Hotel. And for better or for worse, it is, we can now currently see the effects of this meeting through Peter Jackson's Get Back. We see them going to the meeting and we see the aftermath of the meeting. And it's important. Everything kind of changes from this meeting onwards.
Yes, because Alan Klein will arrive and save the day.
Well, it is remarkable, you know, we said in the first part that hindsight is 20/20 vision, and something that Get Back allowed us to do is to try and look at January 1969 when the future hadn't been written yet. And it was very interesting to watch it from that point of view. And obviously towards the end of the movie, when Alan Klein makes an appearance, not in person, but just the figure, it's kind of ominously, he's ominously invisible. You know, we watched about 7 hours of the movie at that point, and you're kind of thinking, well, you know, in real time, without knowing what's about to happen, you know, why shouldn't that meeting have happened?
Yes, I think
it was totally reasonable to happen.
I think that's right. Clearly, what the Get Back movie does show is there is a lack of direction, there is a lack of control. They're fine when they get in the studio, when they're recording, when they're playing music. They can lose themselves in that. They don't need to get hung up about the business stuff, but the business stuff is all there. And at this point, they're looking for somebody. You know, they've been in touch with other people. They've been in touch with merchant bankers. They've been in touch with Dr. Beeching from the railways, who famously
the railway man, the man who closed down the UK's railways in the 1960s.
Yeah. Mm. So for people that don't live in the UK or much too young to remember when Britain had a railway, he came in and just closed down all of these branch lines and said, look, you know, these are losing money. And of course, these are the very branch lines and things that we could do with now.
Yes, you know, like what Beeching did, and there was a similar movement in Ireland in the 60s to close down railways, was very short-sighted.
Yeah, but they are looking around for someone to come in. And yes, why would they not meet with Klein? Klein has been circling. He has a reputation. He is the manager of the business manager of the Stones at this point. Jagger has spoken to Paul. Paul has previously used Klein's name to throw this up to Brian Epstein in the context of negotiations. So why would they not speak to Klein? I suppose his reputation does not sit comfortably with the utopian ideals that they're espousing for Apple. Yeah. But very quickly, by January 69, they're realizing Apple isn't working. Apple it's not going to work the way that we had envisioned this.
So the first meeting is on January the 27th in the Dorchester, which is a very posh, fancy hotel, if memory serves, off Hyde Park in London. And Klein is ready. He, you know, the thing we said in the first part is that he constantly takes Yoko on a par with John, and is, you know, whether it's cynical or not cynical, but it's the reality of the matter. He takes the two of them as a couple.
Yes, and I think that is crucial in understanding why John is so taken with him. You know, we've looked a little bit at the genesis of their relationship, the effects that it has had, the sort of divisions that it's provoking, plus they're being vilified in the press, they're being made fun of at this time, and here suddenly they have someone who is at least on the face of it taking her seriously. So, I mean, to the extent that he arranges for the hotel to provide, to serve macrobiotic rice for the meat, because he knows that this is the current, I suppose, fad is what you would say, is they're espousing this diet, so he arranges for this particular type of food. He talks about Yoko's art exhibitions, he'll provide funding for her exhibitions, he'll arrange to get her films distributed by United Artists, etc., etc. So he's treating them as equals.
And when he's talking to John, he's kind of playing up his background that, you know, trying to draw Lennon in with parallels. You know, he didn't know his mother, and his father, you know, couldn't raise him, and he was in the orphanage, and, you know, this kind of, you know, unsettled, unclaimed childhood that he'd had. And this cumulative effect seems to work on John and Yoko. And, you know, Alan Klein says, you know, I didn't propose anything that night. He just sort of said, how can I help you? You know, it was a very personal type of meeting, trying to get to know each other. He was scared to death about the money situation. How would you feel sitting there damn near broke, having made millions and millions of pounds, and to end up with nothing but memories? And as we said in the first part, Alan Klein, he knows how to play people.
He does. You know, this idea that they were broke or they would go broke was clearly nonsense. You know, I don't think there's any way they could go broke with sort of just the recurring royalties that are coming in and, you know, continue to come in. But he can sense this fear on Lennon's part, because he can see the money hemorrhaging away. And Lennon becomes, over the course of 1969, he will become particularly outspoken about, you know, the leeches in Apple and the people who are exploiting Apple. And he becomes very agitated about this. What he doesn't see is that a lot of money is being hemorrhaged on, you know, hiring hot air balloons to fly over the English countryside or shipping acorns to people. And Apple is funding all of that at the same time. And there are just no control. So he does have this fear.
And in Alan Klein's defense, there's nothing wrong with being a savvy businessman who knows how to read people and play people. That's just part of the game. And, you know, the other group who are involved in the Beatles at this time is that Paul's almost in-laws, the Eastmans, are also being legal representatives of the Beatles at the time. And they've kind of become almost an exclusive legal representation for the Beatles when John is talking to Alan Klein on the 27th.
That's right. And Klein does say that John said, look, the Eastmans are the exclusive representatives. We can't talk about that. Would you be willing to represent Yoko and me? And Klein said, you know, I was really trying to remain, not appear very anxious. Well, I think we should sleep on it. And he said, well, what's the matter? Don't you want to do it now? Don't you want to sign the deal now? So Klein's retelling of this is really that it's John that's making the running here. He said he went home, or went to bed. Lennon went home, Klein went to bed, and then John phones him later, wakes him up, and says, you know, let's do this. And Lennon says, you know, it was plain to me that Klein came to London expressly to offer his management services to the Beatles. Lennon is prepared to facilitate that, at least at this stage, for Klein to go in on his behalf and look at his financial situation. So again, there's echoes of this, the way that he got the Stones, where he came in as Oldham's business manager. So yep. Lennon is saying, right, well, you come in for me. And then it sort of goes from there, where Klein then begins to offer his services to the other three Beatles as well.
Now, it's probably worth saying in the, you know, in the development of what you might want to call corporation rock in the 70s and 80s, it's not unusual for large bands where different individuals within the band might have a different manager, or certainly a business manager, you know, feeding into the group structure. So that's not, now you can argue whether or not it's the healthiest way of doing things, you know, but, you know, you have some groups like Fleetwood Mac where everybody has their own manager these days, but there's still a brand that goes out and plays and hits the road, you know, it's not unusual.
I think the issue is that we like to think of the Beatles as being these four guys in a gang, and It's sort of all for one and one for all. And that is certainly the way that Paul approaches this. You know, we don't need this kind of interference. Once we get into this, you know, it's just the four of us and we always agree everything and we always move forward together. Plus, they very publicly, you know, planted their flag on this utopian Apple idea of it's not about the money and it's not about the record companies and we want to make a break from this the men in suits. And here they are on the point of bringing, you know, the biggest bastard in a suit in to work for them. And it doesn't sit comfortably with that. And I think Klein's reputation with Beatles fans is that's the starting point. Well, he's not simpatico with what they are. He's not of the brand. He doesn't sit with Apple. This is something completely different. But you can't get away from the fact that by January 1969, all of the Beatles, all four of them, were conscious that they needed to do something.
Yeah. That is true. And what we will see as this evolves a little bit is that there are certain things that Klein does that aren't, you know, this isn't exactly Paul against Klein 100% of the time. So we just need to keep that in mind. But what is striking is just how fast it happens. As you say, you know, John is kind of given the offer to sleep on it. He doesn't even sleep on it. He basically makes a decision to say that, you know, Alan Klein now handles all my stuff. And he tells pretty soon afterwards Sir Joseph Lockwood, chairman of EMI, that, well, me, John Lennon, I'm signed up to the good ship Alan Klein. And that's that. And as I said, you know, you can see the aftermath the following day if you rewind back and watch Get Back. And when you get to the January 28th session of Get Back, there's a conversation between John Lennon and George Harrison where he's recounting this very meeting. And, you know, again, with hindsight, you're watching this going, John, you know, you seem, how could you have been so naive? But, you know, what John says to George is, you know, we were up till 2 a.m. He knows everything about everything. He knows what we're all like. He knows me as well as you do. So he's saying to George Harrison, this guy I met yesterday knows me better than you or as well as you do. He's an incredible guy, says Lennon. And you're watching it going, John, you know, he's hook, line and sinker. He's just gone for it. He's sold.
This is absolutely the case. And again, looking at Lennon's personality, Epstein, Klein, the Maharishi, Arthur Janov, you know, it's back to this COD psychology thing. He's looking for a father figure. He's found someone that he has a degree of empathy with, that it's a reciprocal thing. It's a neat trick that Klein does, which is you know, you can imagine he has a crib sheet of the 10 talking points to get across to Lennon. Learn some lyrics from Lennon's songs, talk about macrobiotic rice, talk about how great Yoko's films are, talk about the orphanage being raised by his aunt, bang, 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 all of those points. Klein is a hustler, he's an operator, and Lennon just is on board. But you know, it's the fact then that Lennon sells it to George and Ringo.
Well, you know, having hovered for so long, what is amazing is that after Klein gets this meeting on January the 27th, he then gets to meet all the Beatles together on January the 28th, like 24 hours later. Biggest band in the world. That's how quickly these kind of things happen. And it might be worth mentioning briefly the Eastmans at this point, because they are also in the picture. So January 1969, Paul is with Linda Eastman, but they are not married. They don't marry until March 1969. But Linda's dad is John Eastman, who is a successful attorney. At this stage, he's about 59 years of age. And he earned his showbiz credentials with Tommy Dorsey. He also represented modern artists like Rothko and de Kooning, and he'd go on to work with Billy Joel and David Bowie and all the rest. So he's a New York lawyer involved in show business and the worlds of fame. And that's Lee Eastman. And Linda's brother, John, is being groomed to be a partner in the Eastman and Eastman firm. And he's obviously younger and a little bit more you know, newer to the business than his dad, but they are presented as a package. And this seems to suit Paul because, you know, he is suitably impressed by the Eastmans and what they are saying. And I think Paul feels that they are not out to hustle him into a contract. He talks specifically that he just pays them on a pro rata basis for any work that they do. And they are bending Paul's ear to say, you know, we have been in the New York show business circle for a while, and Alan Klein is, you know, he's got issues.
Yes, there are two aspects, I think, of the Eastman connection. The first is that their social standing, and it's again tempting to see parallels with the Asher family. So the same way that when Paul arrives up from Liverpool, he very consciously embarks on almost a program of self-improvement. You know, he's kind of, the Asher family is a very impressive setup to him, and they're culturally very clued in to the London scene. It's sort of the theatricality and all the rest of it. And it's a social step up from where he is in Liverpool. That's kind of undeniable. And again, what you've got with Linda's family background, although Linda herself doesn't seem to sort of buy into that and is a bit more of a free spirit, but it's this big New York, you know, there's money, there's big houses, there's connections, and it's impressive. And the second side is, yes, the Eastmans are saying, well, you just pay us for a job of work. You know, it's not that you're not going to sign up for 20 years at 20% or 30%, and we're not going to take percentage of your earnings. You just pay us for the job you want us to do, and we'll set out a retainer and we'll do the job. And they have already sort of come in and been appointed as, I suppose, general counsel. So for legal matters, they're already on, they're on staff, they're on standby, they're on a retainer of some description. Because John mentions this in the Dorchester meeting with Klein. He sort of says, well, look, the Eastmans are in, and you know, so we can't really talk about that, but will you come on board as my business manager? The other thing is the Eastmans are, as you say, saying stay away from Klein. So they're bending Paul's ear and saying he is not a nice character, he is dislikable. But not only that, he's under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission over an alleged stock rigging scheme. And they're just warning him off and saying he's not to be trusted, basically. And Paul, he is getting that advice directly from the Eastmans. But then he's relaying that. So it becomes secondhand through to the other Beatles. So they're kind of saying, well, that's Paul's father-in-law is saying, you know. And so this is where the suspicions start. And I don't think we can underestimate the antipathy between Klein and Eastman, between Eastman and Klein.
They are two totally separate groups of people. And Klein does confirm, you know, in the 1971 court case, you know, that, you know, when he met Lennon in January 69, the Beatles had issued a general retainer to John Eastman to negotiate contracts throughout the world, which was terminable at any time. So, you know, Klein knows that Eastman is there and that Eastman is involved. And again, trying to be totally naive and look at it from the end of January 1969, you know, it's easy for John, George and Ringo to say, well, Paul, of course you have an agenda with your guy. You're marrying into that family. Now, just as a side point, obviously, Lee Eastman and John Eastman eventually go up to, you know, set up MPL and have hugely successful careers, and their work with MPL has turned that into a powerhouse. But heaven forbid that I should say at this early stage that Paul was so wise. I'm going to park that thought because, again, we are trying not to deal in the hindsight vision, the hindsight way of doing things. But Paul kind of gets this pushback that Lee Eastman is a bit too biased. Amazingly, 24 hours after John's original meeting with Alan Klein, and we see this again in Get Back, at the end of the January the 28th session, they go, Alan Klein's here. Hooray. And they just down tools. The other thing I would say about the January 28th day on Get Back is they are drinking so much wine that you're kind of wondering they've all got a belly full of wine and they're going upstairs to meet the abstemious and clear-headed Alan Klein, who's about to chart their course for them. And it's a meeting that depends who you're looking at. Does it go well?
Well, it's not a meeting. It's not a meeting that I don't think we can say it goes well.
Well, the four of them go up and basically four people go into that meeting and maybe not everybody stays. So Klein kind of states his case to the four of them and then Paul leaves, or what happens?
Yeah. There's John Eastman is there and Orion's who's, and Paul leaves. And if I give anybody a free piece of legal advice, is never leave the meeting before the negotiation is over. And I think it's a huge mistake. And possibly you can say this is where it all starts to unravel, is the fact that Paul exits. So yeah. He goes
to take a bath, Stephen. I think that's what he's doing.
Yeah, probably.
He'll be very clean.
He leaves the field. The battle is not over and he leaves the field. So, of course, then that's everything is going to go a different way. And yeah. This is never a good tactic. And it does go a different way. So George and Ringo go, yeah, fine. Can you look at our stuff too?
Mm-hmm. Now, the big thing that is kind of looming is the issue of NEMS. And there has been a rough plan at this time in January 69 that the Beatles themselves would buy out NEMS. And here's where we need legal expertise to try and parse this out and understand it. But as I understand it, the Beatles were going to be given a £1 million advance by EMI. And the Beatles were going to take that £1 million and use it to buy NEMS. NEMS, whose main role at this point in time is filtering the Beatles' money from record sales and taking 25% for themselves for the privilege and passing on 75% of the gross record revenues earned onto the Beatles. And the Beatles are going to buy this basically cash clearinghouse for £1 million, and they're going to get that £1 million from EMI, and EMI are going to claim it as an advance. So once the Beatles have made £1 million, they've paid back the loan to EMI. That is the plan. Is that right?
That is the plan. And the only flaw in the plan is when you said, and when the Beatles have earned £1 million, because we'll come on to that point. How much money would they need to earn to pay back the £1 million advance from EMI, because they're going to look for interest on that. They're not just going to give them, the money, and then there's tax involved. So this is where the plan starts to unravel. But yes, that's essentially it. And this is a plan that John Eastman, so Linda's brother, has come up with this idea. And yeah. He says, I saw Clive Epstein immediately. I told him, look, you can't get money out of the company to pay estate taxes. It's the death duties following Brian's death. Why don't we buy NEMS and you'll get the money as a capital gain?
Yep.
Forget the 25%, which is NEMS' entitlement of the royalties. What's the company worth? 800,000, 900,000? Forget it. We won't quibble. We'll give you £1 million. So just a quick recap. Clive is sitting as the managing director. Queenie Epstein, Brian's mother, has 70%. Clive has 20%. The Beatles have 10%. In late 67, Clive Epstein had already received and refused an offer to sell to Triumph Investment Trust, which is headed up by a merchant banker called Leonard Reichenberg. Mm-hmm. A year later, he tries again. And by this stage, because of the tax situation arising from Brian's death, Clive is more amenable. Reichenberg says, I offered to buy the 70% shares for £620,000. I agreed
to pay Clive £420,000, provided the royalties were coming to NEMS were not less than £350,000 for 2 years. If there were no royalties, he would get £150,000. So this is just an investment trust that is buying that. They have no interest in the music. They have no interest. It's an income-producing entity, and they're buying future income. Queenie Epstein, Clive decide, yeah, this is an offer we want to take, but they feel an obligation to tell the Beatles about this. And this is then in January 69, John steps in and says, well, we'll just buy it for $1 million. We'll get money from EMI. You won't even have to write a check. We'll just do this against a royalty advance. Then Klein arrives on the scene and says, hold everything.
Yeah. And this all goes back to the 1967 EMI deal. So the 1967 deal runs until 1976. So this deal with NEMS is that all the record sales from 67 to 76, all the money goes to NEMS. NEMS takes 25% and gives it to the Beatles. So the roll of the dice, if you're purchasing this, is what is 25% of Beatles record sales going to generate between now and 1976? You know, what is that figure of money? Because you don't want to, you know, pay too much and not generate that amount of cash. Again, just as a sidestep, I'm thinking of Bowie bonds. David Bowie did a very similar thing with Bowie bonds in the late 90s, where he sold off his record sales revenues for the next 9 or 10 years in a form of bonds. And he made about $30 million for himself. And then 2 years later, MP3s collapsed the music business. So the bonds were junk by the end of the term, and Bowie made off with the money. So it's a speculative business. So you're trying to say, well, what is the value? What should I spend in order to get that revenue stream? What are the parallel things that it'll cost me in terms of how many records I'll have to sell? But then in terms of selling it, the 90% owned by the Epstein mother and son, they're trying to say, well, actually, you know, we have a need to sell because of a tax liability inheritance issue. So they have a need to sell. The other people have a want to buy. And the question is, where does that value lie? And as you say, John Eastman has made this deal in theory to buy for $1 million advanced from EMI. And that's kind of the first thing that Klein goes after. And it's in this meeting on the 28th of February, he's like, tall for them, hold on, don't do this. And what's his rationale?
Yeah, his rationale is essentially he's saying, firstly, how much money would you have to earn to have £1 million to pay this back? And the answer is not that you would have to earn £1 million, but you'd have to earn in the region of £2 million plus, because you pay tax. So the money that will end up in your account to pay EMI is going to be whittled away by the tax. So you're going to have to work and work and work and work. And I think it's still in Klein's mind that he will be able to sort of relieve EMI of £1 million. Because he'll be able to say, well, you haven't done this and you haven't done that, and they're back royalty. The same thing that he did with Bobby Darin, the same thing that he did with Sam Cooke, that he is convinced that there will be unpaid royalties and there will be something in there that he can use to produce the cash. But it's interesting that the deal between Apple and NEMS is out there. It's being reported on. So on the 2nd of February, Cashbox magazine is saying, Apple Corps, the Beatles enterprise, is to take over NEMS Enterprises, the company built up by the foursome's late manager, Brian Epstein. And they say, just to give you an idea of the figures, it is estimated that Apple receives £750,000 annually. So that's £750,000 in 1969 money in record royalties, while a further £250,000 goes to NEMS. These amounts will obviously swell when proceeds from the massive sales of the foursome's current double album start to flow. By acquiring NEMS, Apple will strengthen its own financial health and obtain a slice of Northern Songs, because NEMS owns shares in Northern Songs. So it's connected there as well.
Yeah, NEMS owns 7.2% of Northern Songs. So this, if you're paying attention. The other business entity we need to keep an eye on is Northern Songs, which is the publishing company that has numerous songs, but particularly the very valuable Lennon and McCartney songbook. NEMS owns 7.2% of Northern Songs, John and Paul, at the start of 1969, own 15% each of Northern Songs. So if you add all that up, that's 37.2% of Northern Songs. And the second thing that's going to come on the horizon as 69 progresses is the ownership of Northern Songs. So park that notion for a second. Once Alan Klein comes in, this NEMS deal gets, kind of halted. And that is that then doesn't really work out, you know. The meeting on the 28th of January, you know, Klein subsequently recounts it in affidavits, is that they meet at about 9 o'clock and they have a general discussion about the proposed purchase of NEMS. And, you know, he says, I can't recommend Mr. Lennon to proceed with the purchase because he's, you know, managed to get John in as a, you know, he represents John now. And he says, you know, that we should discuss this further with the Eastmans present. And in the interim, he's going to do that thing he does, Klein. He's going to go off between the 20th of January and the start of February to look through some accounts. And, you know, this guy who's amazing at looking at a bunch of books but seemingly can't manage a tax return, off he goes to off do goes. That.
Essentially, he says, I'm going to do two things. I'm going to audit EMI's books and that three things. I sound like John Cleese. What have Alan Klein ever done for us? He's going to audit EMI's books, he's going to renegotiate the record contract, and he's going to get Apple back on its feet by removing dead weight. So, true to his word, the first thing that he does is he goes off and spends the remainder of that week at the offices of the Beatles accountants, Bryce Hammer and Co., with a chap called Harry Pinsker, getting all the information that he needs. And he says, well, look, I've got this information, I don't have all the information I need, but we need to put this on hold. So the whole deal stops. He is working without a contract at this stage. So all, you know, the other Beatles, are three of them are prepared to sign. He says, no, we don't need to sign, you know, just I'll go and do this, and then if you're happy. So he's playing a very clever game. Then there
he's playing a different game than he's played with other artists. Yes, where he does get it in writing. And yeah, he's trying to prove his worth. This is when we said in the first part, he does things a little bit differently with the Beatles. You know, he's essentially doing something that he doesn't normally do, which is work for free without a contract.
Yes, essentially. This is the way he's proceeding. He's also then saying, well, we need to have the Eastmans on board. So he obviously knows that Paul is not happy with this. He knows the Eastmans don't like him particularly. There is another meeting on the 1st of February, and again, a lot of what we quote from here are the affidavits that Klein files in court subsequently in the court actions, and you know, they're all written in legalese, they're all quite formal, and they're all written at a time when he's trying to make a point and set out evidence. So we can't take these as being, you know, it's not that a third party is in the room making an objective assessment, but what he says is, at this second meeting on the 1st of February, Paul McCartney introduced the subject of Northern Songs and said that he wanted the Beatles to own it. Klein wants to defer that until they sort out the issue with NEMS. And then he said, at this stage, John Eastman launched a personal attack on my integrity, producing a copy of the Cameo Parkway proxy statement. This is a reference back to the stock rigging allegation that was going on in New York. Clippings from newspapers. He alleged I had a bad reputation. I invited him to make specific charges or criticisms, but he did not do so. I think my answer satisfied the Beatles, and I suggested that John Eastman should be that of legal advisor. And again, this is clever. He's not saying ditch the Eastmans. He's saying, by all means, you know, this young chap should be there as your legal advisor. And Eastman rejects that on the grounds that he's does more than an English lawyer normally does. The meeting broke up and another meeting was arranged for the following Monday on the 3rd of February, again at Savile Row. So this is an extremely cantankerous meeting, and Eastman is making personal attacks on Klein.
There's a couple of things to pull out from that. One is, you know, while he goes off after the 28th to delve through the books, the Beatles are going up onto the roof. They're fannying about on the roof.
Wasting their time when they could be looking at accounts.
Well, exactly. But, you know, if Brian had been alive, he would have been sat or stood, arms folded at the side of that roof. He wouldn't have been knee deep in accounting books. And, you know, you rewind back to the Get Back film, you know, on the 29th, you know, after the big meeting with the four of them where Paul leaves early, you know, John says to Ringo, oh, I was with Alan Klein till 12 or half 12. And you have this, you know, very interesting, you know, Glyn Johns is basically trying to warn them that this is a strange man, a clever man, but he's a bit off. And Glyn Johns says an amazing thing, which is he probably talks to you differently than how he talks to the likes of us. Meaning, you know, you're a Beatle and he's talking to you in a Beatle way. He's not giving you, you know, the elbow. And Ringo makes his famous comment that he's a con man on our side. And then, you know, they're up on the roof the next day while Klein is going through the books and, you know, Ringo's supposed to be off doing the Magic Christian, but here we are, it's the first week of February and John Eastman has flown over from New York. And the other thing to remember is that John Eastman is the son, and there's a little bit of kind of an inference that, well, I'm big bad Alan Klein and you've sent over the boy, not Lee Eastman himself hasn't turned up. And that's also used as a bit of a slight or to kind of undermine the situation.
Yes, and I have to say, dispassionately trying to be objective, I do have a respect for what Klein is able to do in these meetings, because he does seem to just be able to play any hand that he's dealt. So, you know, he turns the personal attacks that he receives from John Eastman against Eastman. He offers him, apparently magnanimously, says, oh, yeah, but that's fine. You can continue to be the legal advisor. And then Eastman realizes, well, that would put him in a subsidiary role, and he's kind of walked into that. And you do just get a sense that Klein is running rings around everybody in that room, you know, not just Eastman, but the Beatles and McCartney. And part of this is because what Klein is trying to do does actually dovetail with what Paul wants. You know, Paul wants NAMs. Paul wants Northern Songs, and Klein is saying, well, I'm not against that. Let me see if there's a better way I can finance this.
And more pointedly, Paul doesn't want them for himself. He wants them for the Beatles, you know. He wants John on board, and he wants Apple on board, and he wants this kind of, again, you know, we see it with MPL, how he set that up as a solo artist. He basically wants a version of MPL for the Beatles, where it's all under the Apple umbrella. They own Northern Songs, finally. They own NEMS. They get their recordings back on track. That's what they want. And there's a later interview in the 70s with Paul and Linda where, you know, Paul, you know, is talking, you know, oh, I should probably rant and rave about the other three, but, you know, I just, you know, they think I'm trying to pull a fast one. And, you know, he talks about how Klein said things like, you know, if you guys want NEMS or Northern Songs, I'll buy it for you and I'll give it to you. That's always a red flag if some kind of business manager says that. Oh, I'll just hold it here for you and pass it on. I'm sure he said that to the Stones. I'll just buy these recording masters off Andrew Oldham and pass them on to you eventually. But the actual savvy, sane thing that Paul says is, you know, he says to George, you know, I can't do it. He talks about how, you know, this is post the concert for Bangladesh, that Paul is very wary about doing anything to kind of support Klein in the aftermath of all of this. Paul kind of knows that there's a value and a worth in what he attaches himself to and what he doesn't attach himself to. So, you know, when he's fighting Klein later on in court, he doesn't really want to give Klein any reasonable credit. He's kind of forced into a position where he can't really acknowledge any of the stuff that Klein has done.
Exactly. And he's talking to this interview is in 1971. And one interesting exchange in that is he said, Paul says, so Klein at that meeting says, listen, I think the guys shouldn't buy this. And I think it's so much and the guys shouldn't spend a million. And Linda interrupts and says, boys. He said, boys. Mm. And Paul went, yeah, the boys. So, and you think even that, he's picked that up from watching Epstein interviews where he talked about the boys. So he's even clever in the specific use of language, how he's referring to them in the same way that Epstein referred to them. So he's that's the nice side of Klein. And Paul does say, you know, Alan's a nice fella, a good talker. The others really dig him. They really like him. So you can't say anything bad there. You can't tell them not to. I think I've made a mistake, actually, in trying to advise them. Every time I ring up and say, look, he's at 1.5 million and you haven't got it, I think it just pisses them off. I think they secretly think I might be right, too. So this is in 1971, where Paul, with a little bit of hindsight, is sort of saying, well, you know, like every time I try to warn them off, it just reinforces the sense that it's a personal thing, or that I'm trying to pull a fast one. And he sort of, by 1971, he's kind of realizing that tactically he's not played the right game against Klein. You know, Klein is not somebody you can take on head to head, I think.
And so what happens is another meeting is planned after the 1st of February for the 3rd of February. And this time Lee Eastman flies over as the more senior partner of Eastman and Eastman to meet with the Beatles plus Klein. And we will discuss that after this break.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So it's February 1969. They are having meetings. And the 3rd of February 1969, we have... Let's count it out. It's an amazing group of people. If this was a lineup at a gig, you'd be delighted. You have the Eastmans, John and Lee Eastman, son and father. You have the Beatles, John, Paul, Ringo and George, George and Ringo. And you have Alan Klein and you have Mick Jagger. What? Why? Yes, why does Mick Jagger appear?
Mick on backing vocals. So this is an absolutely fascinating meeting. And it does, to me, indicate just... how established Klein had become in just a matter of a few days. So Eastman Senior flies to London because the meeting on the 1st of February has gone so disastrously and was so acrimonious. Now, I have to say, not before time does Lee Eastman arrive in London.
Yeah, he should have been there sooner.
Lee Eastman should have been there sooner. But anyway, Paul has invited Mick to come along to a meeting with the Beatles, is how it is presented, because Paul wants Jagger to basically share his experience. And Jagger arrives at Apple and finds that Klein is in the boardroom. Mm. So Jagger doesn't know that Klein is going to be there. So suddenly faced with Klein, he can't bring himself to say, look him in the eye and say, this guy's a crook, or this guy, you need to watch him. And he just kind of says, he's all right, if you like that sort of thing.
that's kind of the famous Jagger phrase. Yeah, Klein is all right, if you like this sort of thing. And it's a very, I mean, yeah, I feel sorry for Jagger in that situation, because, again, you know, thinking through the Get Back prism of who's there looking out for these guys, that it actually takes the lead singer of the Rolling Stones is trying to go over to the four Beatles to say, look out for Alan Klein. Alan Klein is there and he isn't really able to get his message across. And if anything, the presence of Lee Eastman and John Eastman together, things just get worse. And in reality, there's nothing clever about what Klein is doing. It's just classic divide and conquer techniques. And he's trying to divide and conquer the Beatles. He's trying to divide and conquer the Eastmans and Paul. But he's also simultaneously realizing that, you know, the way to do that is not just to dismiss the Eastmans fully, but irrespective of the fact that the Eastmans have tried to flag up things like, you know, Klein being under investigation by the Securities Commission and being involved in about 40 lawsuits in the USA, you know, Klein is kind of hitting back and it gets a bit ugly. You know, they point out things like the Eastmans, their original name when they moved to the US was Epstein. And, you know, it's kind of... almost a strangely, almost like a anti-Semitic type kind of attack on them. And it's all just not good.
It is not good. It is not good. Lee Eastman turns up clutching a sheaf of papers and newspaper clippings that all the negative things and all the bad reports about Klein. And this is the point at which, for me, it sort of tips into being just a personal fight between Klein and the Eastmans. Mm. And it does seem to me that antipathy between the two parties is the main driver for quite a number of weeks and months in the breakdown of the relationship. So as you say, Lee Eastman, the family, they're Jewish immigrants from Russia, and his original name was Leopold Epstein. Mm. but he changes his name. And this is kind of, you know, Klein uses this to appeal to Lenin's sense of, being against snobbery and being, you have to be very honest and you have to be very upfront. And this guy is sort of hiding his Jewish background. And eventually he starts interrupting everything that Eastman is saying. And he goads Eastman into just losing his temper. There is a massive, you know, outburst, and he discredits himself effectively. He just lets himself down.
Well, he does. And I mean, it's, first of all, Alan Klein, you have to think that he obviously assumes that everybody else is in it for the reasons that he's in it. And, you know, taking the Eastmans at face value, they were on retainer. They weren't necessarily trying to get the Beatles to sign anything that made them manager. But Klein said in subsequent affidavits, you know, out of the clear blue, John Eastman was already there and Lee Eastman arrived after a bit. You can be sure they wanted to take over as managers. I baited Lee Eastman a bit. He blew his cool and started screaming and cursing at me. That settled it. They knew what he was like then, all except Paul. And, you know, any witness in the courts, you'll tell them, don't lose your cool. You know, if you're being cross-examined, that's kind of the first failure. Well,
that's it. And Lennon talks about it. When he talks about it, he said that Eastman was the bully in the room. And he said, we hadn't been in there more than a few minutes when Lee Eastman was having something like an epileptic fit and screaming at Alan that he was the lowest scum on earth and calling him, all sorts of names. And then, Paul is joining in with this. So the whole thing deteriorates. And it seems to be clear at this point that this is just a fundamental issue. And Paul, in his court affidavit, he says this is the first time in the history of the Beatles that a possible irreconcilable difference had appeared between us. And again, he's talking about a possible irreconcilable difference. But again, this affidavit is written in 1971. He needs to convince the court that even coming out of that meeting, it wasn't wholly irrecoverable.
Well, yes, and that's the thing, because nothing still is in paper. By the end of February the 3rd, 1969, Klein is informally appointed as the Beatles' business manager and is more or less told to go away and drum up the papers. And whether Paul, in his brain, was thinking, well, nothing is signed yet, let's just see what happens with these papers, let's just wait. And as we'll find out in a second, those papers don't arrive until 3 months later at the start of May. So there's this period between February and May where Klein is the business manager of the Beatles, but it is not signed, sealed and delivered. And at that point, there is definitely, it's John, George, Ringo and Klein on one side, and Paul is not totally signed up for this in any way. But out of a sort of a nod to Paul, the Eastmans do remain on retainer as a compromise, as Apple General Counsel. And you would imagine Paul was kind of waiting to see how this would shake out before anything gets signed up in paper.
I think there's an element of that because, Apple, Derek Taylor does put out a statement saying the Beatles have asked Mr. Alan Klein of New York to look into all their affairs and he has agreed to do so. It was announced from the headquarters at Apple, Savile Row, London, today. So that comes out of that meeting, a very acrimonious meeting, but there is that appointment. No contracts are signed yet. And the first thing he does, same day, goes and speaks to Clive Epstein to talk about NAMS.
Well, that's the thing. Alan Klein has essentially 3 months to prove himself. He has to, if he's going to get those names on the dotted line, he has to prove his worth and all his skills. And so the first thing he's going to try and prove is the NAMS deal. And he goes to Clive Epstein and he sort of says, can I have 2 or 3 weeks to just go through the books and revise everything and look at what's going on?
And Clive agrees to do this. That's a success. The sale to Triumph is put on hold. Epstein says, right, 3 weeks, happy to sit for 3 weeks. Klein says, the following day, I left for New York to begin an investigation into the three main sources of the Beatles' income in order to verify their financial position. United Artists Corporation, the company which handled the films, General Artists Corporation, which held the tour, EMI and Capital. So again, you can see he's looking back at the touring income. Is there money to be recovered there? And the Beatles have signed authorities for him to go to each of these companies, each of these income sources.
And these are obviously the income sources that are going into NEMS that we've mentioned before. These are kind of
basically
where they are
so
from.
So he's going back to the source. You know, so the Beatles haven't toured for 3 years, but he's going to go back and he's going to look at those papers and sort of see. And again, one of the fascinating things is there is a running commentary in all of this in the press. So Cashbox magazine on the 8th of February still reporting this, and they're saying, oh, there's still no indication about who might join the Apple board to reorganize it. But one name that's being speculated on is Nat Weiss. If you remember, that is Brian's lawyer, and he hosted John and Paul when they were in New York setting up Apple. So all of this is sort of, there's a hiatus, and everything is proceeding. And then it's Valentine's Day.
And there's a bit of a Valentine's Day, if not a massacre, it's certainly the Valentine's Day misstep. So, you know, the Klein has been given roughly till the last week in February to sort out the accounts and to make sure everything is the way he likes it. And then there's this really strange letter on the 14th of February from John Eastman to Clive Epstein. And you know, after the fact, John Eastman says Klein made him write it. Klein denies saying him write it. But he writes this letter to John Eastman writes this letter to Clive Epstein saying, as you know, Mr. Alan Klein is doing an audit of the Beatles affair vis-a-vis NEMS and Nemperor Holdings Limited. When this has been completed, I suggest we meet to discuss the results of Mr. Klein's audit, as well as the propriety of the negotiations surrounding the 9-year agreement between EMI, the Beatles and NEMS. Now, you might read that initially and gloss over the thing, the little bomb that's in that paragraph. But Clive Epstein had a huge problem with this letter.
Yes. So the suggestion there in that final phrase that we will look at the propriety of the negotiations surrounding the 9-year agreement between EMI, the Beatles and NEMS. There is a definite suggestion that something is not right there. You know, there's a bad smell about this negotiation. You know, was there some kind of incentive that wasn't disclosed that NEMS has received? But there is a very explicit suggestion that there's something inappropriate has gone on with the negotiation. Now, in the context of the NEMS deal, if that is right, and the deal that has been done is flawed or tarnished or capable of being overturned, NEMS loses its income, loses its worth.
They don't need to take it over. Yeah.
They don't need to take it over. So all of these things. Now, it seems to me, looking at that, it must have been a deliberate attempt to unsettle Clive Epstein. That is not, you know, this is a legal letter.
Yeah.
No matter how young, no matter how inexperienced the lawyer might be, that is something that is being written very purposefully.
Well, it's that one word, propriety, that's kind of unusual, because, you know, even if he'd said, you know, we can discuss the details of the of the 9-year agreement or the fine print of the 9-year agreement, you know, I think that'd be reasonable to say, look, we'll meet it all up and then we'll see the audit versus what you've agreed, what we've agreed and all the rest. But it's this interesting thing about the Epsteins is that they are very much all about decency and above boardedness and all the rest. And that word propriety to Clive Epstein is like red rag to a bull.
Yes. He takes this very badly, very badly. He's saying, well, this is an insult to my late brother. And he responds immediately saying, before any meeting takes place, please be good enough to let me know precisely what you mean by the phrase, the propriety of the negotiation. So he's absolutely honed in on this. Now, John Eastman says Klein told him to write that letter. If that were the case, I would be expecting a lawyer to write back and say, well, this is against my advice, because I think this will unsettle the other side. I don't think, you know, lawyers are very used to keeping themselves right. And I don't really understand what the purpose was, other than perhaps, again, to flag up Klein is going to behave in a very aggressive way. But there's no need to flag that up. Everybody knows that.
Yeah.
And it, according to you know, other insiders, Neil Aspinall and Nat Weiss, it kind of gets worse. So Neil Aspinall says John Eastman kept wanting to attach these tax warranties to the deal, and I kept saying to him, shut up, will you? Because I could see the whole deal was getting screwed up by this and that Clive didn't like the idea. And then he says, if you ask me, Lee Eastman was stupid to send his son over. You tell me, would you send your son to do business with John Lennon? Mm. So that, again, I think that's a misstep. And then Nat Weiss says, John Eastman seemed to think that they, the Beatles, were going to be angry with Klein. Lee flew to London thinking Klein would be ready to give up. It was like expecting Hitler to be scared off by the Liechtenstein army. In the end, he was hoping Klein would be prepared to compromise, but Klein wasn't prepared to share control if he could get it at all.
Well, that's the key phrase. Like, where has Klein ever shared control with anybody? You know, he's it's a zero-sum game for Alan Klein.
Absolutely. But the direct response is to that letter from John Eastman is Clive Epstein reopens the negotiations with the Triumph Investment Trust. So having agreed to a three-month hiatus, only a few days later, on the 14th of February, that's all off. And the rival bids are discussing it again, you know?
And by the 17th of February, Triumph acquire, just 3 days later, 70% of the shares of NEMS and Emperor Holdings for £750,000. So they essentially buy the 70% owned by Brian's mum, Queenie, that she had inherited from Brian, which means, you know, that kind of covers the estate taxes and the inheritance issues. And Clive keeps his 20% and the Beatles keep their 10%. And Leonard Reichenberg, who's the man who's behind Triumph, talks about, when we did this deal, there's a lot of eyebrows were raised in the city, merchant bankers buying into show business. But as we said earlier on with Prince Rupert, this is the way it's going, where this is where money is and these people manage money.
Yes, this is an income generating entity, and it's no more than that. It doesn't matter whether they're writing songs, selling records, making widgets. It's just producing money.
Neil Aspinall is informed of this on February the 21st. Alan Klein's affidavit says, you know, he got a phone call from Neil Aspinall on the 21st of February, 69, saying that Triumph had purchased a controlling interest in NEMS. And in a wonderful bit of affidavit speak, Alan Klein says, I was shocked and dismayed by this turn of events. And the official announcement is made on the 24th of February. And so Klein decides to go full Klein and meets Leonard Reichenberg on the 25th of February from Triumph, who've taken over the 70%, to say, you know, you need us some money, and does a virtual holding him by the ankles outside the window to say, give me my Beatles money, damn it.
Yes, so I mean, this must have been quite startling for Reichenberg. You know, he's a London merchant banker, and suddenly he's confronted with Klein. Now he writes about this afterwards, and he appears much more sanguine about this and much more calm, I imagine, than when actually faced. But he said, I didn't know who Alan Klein was. For all I knew, he might have been a nasty little gangster. I only agreed to see him because Clive asked me to see him for Lennon's sake. He said, you're very smart to have jumped in first and bought NEMS, but what you didn't know was that Epstein's owed the Beatles huge sums of money from roadshows. Did I tell him to get lost on that first occasion? No, I put it in slightly stronger terms. Our deal with NEMS was well secured with all kinds of warranties and guarantees, so I didn't see any point in continuing the discussion. So it's New York gangster, street fighting accountant meets sophisticated merchant banker who is ice cool. And that's the clash.
I'm assuming this, I hate to conjure the spectre of somebody like William Rees-Mogg, but anybody who's familiar with this current UK politician who's an investment banker who sort of really is quite happy to tell people that I don't really care what you think.
Yeah.
And bye-bye now. See you later. He doesn't really care about Alan Klein. Alan Klein, he loves a good lawsuit or a bit of rancor. 24 hours later, he decides we need to sort this out, and gets the Beatles involved in signing a letter to send to EMI to say, hey, don't pay them the money, pay us the money directly. We're the Beatles, that's what you need to do. And EMI kind of say, well, you know, what should we do? Who do we send this money to? Maybe we should just send it to nobody.
just send it to nobody. Now, the key thing here is all four of the Beatles sign this letter.
They do.
Paul is on board. EMI, as you say, don't know how to react, and they just say, right, well, we're not going to send the money anywhere until you... So you need to kind of just go and sort this out. Then it goes to court.
The money is just frozen. That's what the court decides. So the EMI are kind of stuck between, you know, the Beatles, who are the people who are actually making the money, and the NEMs, who are the people who are claiming that they have the right to organise the money. And so EMI say, we'll just put it into a frozen account, and this needs to be sorted out from a legal point of view. You know, we love a good legal breakdown of things here on Nothing Is Real. But yeah. That's kind of what happens.
That is, and Reichenberg talks about going to see Sir Joseph at EMI, and he said he was being advised by Len Wood and several panicky lawyers, all scared out of their wits that the Beatles might not sing anymore or might just sing the national anthem backwards if EMI paid the royalties to NEMS and not to Apple. So I phoned Lockwood, called him a chicken for backing down, declined, but he'd done it anyway. And then we enter that period where the lawyers earn their money, the writs are issued, everything is running, and on the 1st of April, perhaps fittingly, it gets to court. But in the interim, what's happening in March? Paul and Linda get married, George and Patty get busted, John and Yoko get married in Gibraltar, near Spain. This is the you know, are the Beatles together? Are they not together? What's going on here? Ringo gives an interview saying, I don't miss being a Beatle anymore. John is still saying the Beatles will give several shows this year. George, this is my favourite quote, we can see each other quite clearly, and by allowing each other to be each other, we can become the Beatles again. And the fourth Beatle, Sid Bernstein, is saying, I'll give you $4 million for four shows in the United States. And then importantly, on the 28th of March, Dick James and Charles Silver agree to sell their shares in Northern Songs to Lou Grade. So that's all happening in the background while this litigation is about to come to court.
And if we have episodes, you know, the Ballad of John and Yoko episodes that we have, kind of map out, you know, how John and Yoko are living the life of the Ballad of John and Yoko at this point. So having had a very intensive period at the end of January and the start of February, where all four Beatles and lawyers and everything are all locked in a room, they've kind of taken a back seat to some of this stuff, and it's given time to play out. And as you say, this kind of comes to the courts quite quickly in April 1969, and there's a couple of efforts in the court proceedings to point out what a rascal Alan Klein is, you know, that the counsel for Triumph say that Apple have fallen under the influence of Mr. Alan Klein. He seemed to have a somewhat dubious record, you know, but that really doesn't matter in the cold light of day of the courts.
No, I mean, the courts are looking at this from a purely contractual point of view, and this speculation where they're saying, oh, but if EMI pay the royalties to the Beatles, they might give it to Klein and he might run off, abscond with the money. The court isn't just not interested in this. They are basically looking at this from a legal point of view, and they say, well, there is no reason not to keep that money just frozen while the contractual situation is resolved. Meanwhile, Reichenberg, taking a leaf out of the Alan Klein playbook, engages a detective. Mm-hmm. And he runs financial legal checks on Klein and produces, you know, they produce a report, and he sends it to the Sunday Times. Mm. So you can see immediately this merchant banker is picking up the same tools as Klein uses to fight Klein. And on the 13th of April, there's an article in the Sunday Times published called "The Toughest Wheeler Dealer in the Pop Jungle."
Yeah, and that Sunday Times article says, Alan Klein's business practices are a startling blend of bluff, sheer determination and financial agility, together with an instinct for publicity and the ability to lie like a trooper. He is a veteran of some 40 lawsuits, and dealings in one of his shares was halted by the American Stock Exchange. In one of his better-known achievements, he himself took over one of his own companies and saw the value of the stock go up by $15 million. It's kind of Alan Klein being played at his own game.
It's a good trick if you can do it. Could I take over Nothing Is Real and our stock price?
I don't know. I think if we signed up for Acast Plus, we could pay ourselves money. Does that make sense?
Yeah, something. We need to get Alan Klein in. Alan Klein sues the Sunday Times.
Yeah,
but successfully, I would say they apologized. But what it does do is it convinces Klein that Reichenberg is an opponent to be reckoned with.
Mm. And Lee Eastman meets with Reichenberg to see if there's any way of getting Nems back into the Beatles as well. But that that doesn't really happen. And Reichenberg does say, "I knew they were hostile to strangers owning a piece of them, but I made it very clear to Clive Epstein that they got a very good offer for their shares, and I thought the boys were okay and that Klein was no good." But they're not really direct contacting Reichenberg directly. And you kind of have to ask, if the money is frozen at this point, that's obviously making cash flow issues even worse.
Yes, I think that's the leverage for the compromise that's brokered. So neither side is faring particularly well. Mm. Reichenberg's investment trust has bought this to secure income. So by the 24th of April, a compromise is hammered out. So essentially, NEMS gives up its claim to 25% of the Beatles royalties for the next 9 years. Instead of that, they get £750,000 in cash. They get 25% of the royalties, which EMI has frozen. They receive £50,000 for NEMS' 23% in the film company, the Beatles film company, Subba Films, and they receive 5% of the gross record royalties from 1972 to 1976. So they've secured a source of income. Now, yeah. that seems quite low, 5%, but it's 5% of the gross.
Yeah, the gross.
And also, Reichenberg knows that the next thing Klein is going to try and do is negotiate an increased royalty rate. And in the context of what we'll come on to in parts 8 and 9 of the Klein episode, the Beatles receive an option on the 4.5% of Northern Song shares that are owned by NEMS.
Yeah.
Plus they get 266,000 shares in Triumph in exchange for the Beatles 10% in NEMS. So there's like a share swap. So everybody's happy, or at least everybody's not as happy as they wanted to be, but that's the sign of a good deal.
It's very curious, because at the start of this deal, you have John Eastman saying, "We're going to buy this for £1 million, and EMI are going to give us £1 million, and we'll earn it back through record sales." And Klein, who's supposed to be the saviour, has ended up bringing this through the courts, and there's a cost involved in that, which isn't built into these costs of legal fees and lawyers and all the rest. You know, they pay Triumph / NEMS, you know, 750 grand plus, you know, 300 grand is taken from the royalties that are frozen. And then there's another 50 grand for the Subba films. So that's 1.1 million that they're already down, that has to be paid for this, that they're not getting from EMI. Granted, that frees up the other 75% of the royalties, which rough calculation is, about 900,000. So the bit of the royalties that returns to them, they're essentially flipping back over to Triumph to pay off all these bills. It's kind of a perfect money go round, and they're going to lose, as you say, 5% of gross Beatle royalties going from 72 to 76, which is going to be a not inconsiderable sum of money.
But less than the 25% they would otherwise have been paying.
Less than the 25% they would have given away, but cumulatively, versus the million that John Eastman wanted to spend.
Oh, yes.
It's not a good deal.
It's not a good deal. It is not a good deal. But the question is, why did the deal fall off the table? The deal fell off the table because of the letter that was written saying, "We're going to question the propriety of these original negotiations." And that's what sent Clive running back into the arms of Triumph. Mm. And, again, that seems to me to be an absolutely central issue, is that letter. And there's a little last minute wrinkle in this deal, which is also quite telling. Mm. So, everything is done. Klein has got Paul's signature and all the agreements, but then he gets a word from
the Eastmans, saying that they had been instructed to withdraw Paul's authorization to exchange the documents with Triumph until Klein and Abco agree not to take any fee for this negotiation. Klein storms across to the EMI studios at Abbey Road and gets hold of Paul, says what has happened. Now, again, could you imagine Epstein doing this?
Nope.
You know, where you kind of storm across the studio. Klein says, Paul said, that's ridiculous, and left the room. And then Klein says, after a few minutes, he returned, having evidently made a phone call, and he said, it's all right, it's good now. I believe he must have instructed his solicitors to agree the exchange of documents. So is that another example of Paul just at the last minute trying to get, you know, that little extra saving on a fee for Klein? Is he trying to make a point with Klein, or is this something that the Eastmans did off their own
I guess Paul is trying to answer the question of, you know, are we controlled by APCO, or are we kind of hiring this guy as a, you know, a separate business manager, you know? So who is Alan Klein, or, you know, where is APCO and all of this is a reasonable question to ask. It does get reported in the trade papers, Cashbox again, the Beatles leave NEMS in Triumph deal. I mean, it sounds like it's a triumphant deal, but that's not the point. Triumph's just the name of the company.
That's not the point.
Alan Klein is quoted as saying in an article at the time of saying, new arrangements have been made which will give the Beatles the independence they desire. And they've settled their differences. At the end of the day, the differences were settled out of court. And it kind of goes through all those percentages that we mentioned earlier on. It's as an audition for Alan Klein, it's not the best audition in the world. I suppose he can, you know, if you're looking at it in black and white, NEMS are out of the picture, and you can say that's a good thing. And now we're going to get all our money, and we've solved that problem. And you know, the deal finally gets sorted out, paperwork wise, in August the 27th, 1969. Right when they are not spending any more time together as Beatles, it's all.
And Klein does spin it. You know, he does, as you say, well, look, NEMS have no further control. And he does point out, and this is a genuine point, the Beatles are now shareholders in Triumph. So the money that's going to Triumph, they will get a little tiny bit of that back because they are shareholders. Eastman, on the other side, John Eastman, writes a letter to each of the four Beatles saying, before memories become too short, I want to remind everybody that we could have settled the NEMS affairs for very little. Klein killed my deal by claiming all sorts of improper acts of NEMS. But John, it was your letter that did that.
Well, John does say that, you know, he does write to the Beatles and say, you know, we do know that NEMS tied up 1.4 million of Beatles recording royalties, which Klein had been unable to free. He has no defences against NEMS retaining your royalties. You know, the proposed settlement, which will cost you more than £1.5 million, was forced upon Klein, not induced by him. And these are the facts. I'm more happy to give you chapter and verse. But John Eastman is assuming, if we've learned anything in the 21st century, Steve, and it's that facts can't compete with emotions.
No. But again, it seemed to me to be unprofessional to be writing as a lawyer to your client in those terms. Mm. And it does seem to me repeatedly, this is just another example of a personal battle between, there's just that antipathy between the Eastmans and Klein. And obviously by this stage, they're in-laws, they're in the family.
Well, that is the thing that has changed. They are now relations of Paul. And John Eastman says, you know, Klein was the fly in the ointment. I didn't like the man's reputation. I didn't like the way he operated. It isn't my style. But Lennon liked him and he talked the others into liking him. True, I wanted NEMS to assume the complete liability for taxes, but that wasn't important. Klein showed up in the meantime and said, forget it. I'll get you NEMS for nothing because the Epsteins owe you money. And it was because of Klein that deal fell through. And Paul kind of reinforces this, and I suppose, of course, he would. Part of my reason for not wishing to have Klein as manager was based on what he failed to do between the beginning of that year, 69, and May. Klein told us, we'll get NEMS for nothing. It's a typical example of the exaggerated way Klein expressed himself to us at the time, and it was because of moments like this that I gradually became more and more determined that Klein was not the right man to be appointed manager. Which, you know, if this was his first act in his audition to prove himself to the Beatles, Paul sees that he has failed the audition. The others have probably seen that he has passed the audition. And Paul might feel he has failed the audition because his in-laws are constantly bending his ears to say these are the actual facts of the issue. And I think Paul is dealing in facts, and I think they are reasonable facts to say this could have been wrapped up for £1 million in January with EMI back paying it and we'd just be none the wiser. But here we are, and it's cost us more money, and it's things have become more convoluted. But Klein seems to think that it gives him license 3 months down the line, that the paperwork is drawn up and he wants to have it in writing with four signatures that he is the managing director of Apple Corps. And this leads to, you know, what's kind of euphemistically called the Liberty Bell, the crack in the Liberty Bell event, where Klein wants everyone to get this signed. And it's funny how personal this gets, because normally this kind of thing, you know, might be some kind of legal underling who might forward some contracts. Can you just sign all of this stuff and we'll all be done? Klein is really, he almost needs to see these signatures happen in person. And again, the issue is Paul, getting Paul's signature on the line.
Yes, because it's this is the stage at which the Northern Songs issue has come into play. So while we're wrapping up the Triumph deal, Northern Songs has come onto the table. So Klein has been working for 6 months effectively by this stage with no contract, and this needs to be resolved. This needs to be resolved before Klein can go in and negotiate in the context of Northern Songs, because he has seen what has happened in the NEMS negotiation, where people are working without contracts. People, the terms of the retainer, the terms of what each individual person is tasked with doing and what the limit of their responsibility is absolutely crucial. And at this stage, we have at least two or three teams of people all working and crossing into each other's areas. So yeah, this is the next thing we come on to is Northern Songs and the need to formalise the contractual situation.
So it's Friday the 9th of May. Three Beatles have signed the contract with Alan Klein, but it takes four Beatles to make it stand up in court. And the one Beatle who's outstanding is Paul McCartney, and Alan Klein isn't having any of it, and Paul McCartney isn't having any of it. But that's where we're going to press pause on the never-ending story of Alan Klein and the Beatles, and we'll take up the next part in, obviously, part three of Nothing Is Real's look at Alan Klein. We remain available in all the usual places. www.nothingisrealpod.com is the website. At BeatlesPod is the Twitter. The Nothing Is Real Facebook group, over 6,000 people chatting about the Beatles. All our other social stuff is available on the website, as is all the other bits and pieces related to Nothing Is Real. We have a whole range of alternate episodes over on Acast Plus, and we want to thank all our supporters who help us keep the lights on here for all the regular episodes and the bonus episodes at Nothing Is Real. Acast Plus, you can investigate that on nothingisrealpod.com, where you get bonus episodes on Paul McCartney's Bird and all sorts of strange and magical, wonderful things. Beatles houses, you know, who'd have thought we could talk for 3 hours on where each individual Beatle has lived? But it's all over on Acast Plus, everybody. So go have a look and investigate that. And thanks to all our supporters so far. But for now, my name is Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.